Albert, meet that, took that photograph.
Nice.
And that's the Ngutuk whale behind behind him. I was in the tent changing my boots. When one of the guys come running and said, "You're dead," to struck a whale right from the shore. And it sounded. So I quickly finished changing my boots, went down. And he said it sounded, and when it came up to the south of us, right by Tom Brower, his older brother. And they put one bomb into it, killed it, but he was already in the process of dying, I guess, because he struck it right in a vital spot. And Tom Brower thought he got a whale till he rolled in and the float popped up. And he had my dad's name on it. So they went over and told my dad, "Hey, your whale is over there. Bring it, take it to your camp." And he just went around the point, tied up to it, and towed it around and took it to our camp. And that's the picture right there of him.
So it was mid-80s, early-80s, when he last went out whaling?
Yeah, mid-80s, I think. Because the last time I landed a whale for him was 1991. Got an Ngutuk up there too.
So that last one that he struck, was that the last time he was out whaling?
Physically out whaling, yes. After that, his health went down and he just started staying home. He didn't go out in the ice, he just left it to me and the crew.
But he was still...
He's still the boss, he was the admiral. That was the captain. He had given me the wedding gear. Late 70s, 79, 80, somewhere around 18. He said, "It's going to be years." I said, "No, Dad. It's going to be your crew till you leave us. Then it'll be mine." And the fall of 92 was the last time that the flight went up in his house. We got the fall. We didn't get the spring whale yet. He left us that spring. So we weren't hunting too hard then. That fall, we got a 37-foot whale, and after we butchered it, I made a statement that this is the last time you're going to see. Yes, my respects to my father. This is the last time you're going to see the flag in his house. He's going to move. And that's when the crew ownership, which transferred from, officially transferred from my father to me. He has been transferred to me. I've been a captain for years, been my crew. I told my, as long as my father was alive, it was going to be his crew.
Is there any particular whaling stories that stand out in your mind from being with him out there?
Well, the Tata's over there was watch the ice formation. Look how the ice has been formed during the course of the winter. Which way did you get this ice override out there, the evil? Which way did the evil, from the north, or northeast, or from the southwest? Or from the west? From the east side or from the west side? He's going to tell you the story how safe the ice is. If the ice has been jammed up from, and the pressure has been made from the west, from the southwest wind, it's going to be very safe. Because that's when you get your most, that's when you get the most ice pressure coming at you. He's from the southwest. He's coming from the north or northwest, you could say. It's just there's not that much pressure pushing behind it. It can shear off at a later date, but it's been coming from the southwest. It's there to stay. Till you get a good west wind to bring the water, the ocean level up to make it float. But the thing that really stand out the most is when he struck a whale by himself while we're having dinner, and he was saying grace, and we seen Price take off. He was holding onto a gun. He was trying to pull the shoulder gun on a whale. Part of the whale was underneath these young guys that was about a couple feet thick. And I ran to the harpoon that was on the ice, and my father got into the boat, the skin boat, and he said, "Wait. Wait till I put a harpoon into the whale." So nobody did anything till the whale got over the underneath the boat, and he struck. And that thing went straight down. Go straight down, and we couldn't pull it. And he said, "Well, boys," he said, "over the years I've asked for a lot of things, and for the prayer," he said, "I'm going to grab this hand, this rope, the float line rope, with my hands and pray. And I'm going to ask that we pull that whale without losing it." Two other crew, Oliver Levis' crew, came over to help. Arnold Brower Sr.'s crew came over to help, and we pulled and we pulled and we pulled. Finally, we broke that whale loose, and when we pulled it up, and they put another harpoon into it, the harpoon that he had thrown, just the first barb of that harpoon tip was in the whale. And after they put that other harpoon into it, and we pulled it over, that other harpoon just came off. And he made a believer out of us when he said his hands of his can do a lot of things. And that's what stands out the most. Over the years, I've asked my brothers in the summertime to take him hunting. He liked to go caribou hunting, maybe get his winter supply. And they've always had excuses. And I was the one that took time off from work to take, even almost to the point of quitting my work to take him up inland to where he wanted to go with his boat. Even though I would have my own boat ready to go on a weekend, for the weekend trip, he said, "I want to go up inland. I would have to make a quick emergency request to say my dad wants to go camping and he wants to go now. And my younger brother can't take him, so therefore I have to go with him. I have to take him up." Those were the most precious times for me. Instead of being my father, he got to be more than a father. He was like the two brothers, in a sense. And I would tease him. I used to be so afraid of him, but over the years of taking him camping, you get to be real close, and I used to just kid with him. And in one of our later trips, one of the last trips he made out with his aluminum boat, the year before he passed away, we went up to Alaktak River, and we set up camp, and Bryce flew over, told us where the caribou were. I was steering the boat, and I could see all those antlers up there above me. I was piloting the boat, and my dad, I told my dad, "Dad, the caribou above us." And he said, "Where? I can't see him." "You may see, but I can't see him." I said, "Dad, you're getting so old that maybe you should just run the boat while I go up and go shoot." And about that time he said, beach the boat. So I beached the boat on a riverbank. He stepped off. He has his little moccasin shoes on. He started shooting. So I killed the odd board and got the anchor, and I was going to go run up anchor the boat with my, along with the same thing, carry my rifle. He said, just put your rifle away, bring the thermos bottle up, and give me some coffee, and I'll help you skin the caribou. Made 7 shots, and that was it. I got up and went over the river, the bank, and I said, where's the caribou? In my mind, I said, I won't have to really pack, it'd be real close to their shoreline. I only shot the ones I could see. What he had shot was, he just dropped 7 caribou about 100 yards to 150 yards away from the shore. And that was my payback from him, or my punishment for calling him an old man.
And you had to haul all that meat.
I had to skin him, cut him, and haul him myself. While he said he's going to go on guard duty, he had to serve him a bottle of coffee, sugar, and some crackers, and sat by the, he was real dry, and sat by the riverbank and talking to me what I was doing, and saying that I was a spoiled brat and all this stuff. What he was doing, aching me out because I was getting mad, and these were big bulls, and I was, hey, just sat in that big at the hindquarters by myself, throw them on my back and carry them onto the boat, go back at the front quarter. And I fart and wanted to try to get up, I get up and walk down, throw them in the boat, go back and get another one. All 7 of them I did by myself. And by then I was mad, I was pouting. He said, well, let's go back to our tent. And on the way down there, another herd of caribou started coming up close to the river. And he said, son, you want to go shoot some caribou? And I said, hell no. I didn't even stop. I just kept on going and went to our tent. And he got up later on. He said, son, he said, what? Poor baby. You poor baby, you want to go home? That got me out of my pouting mood, and I said, nope, I don't want to go home. We're up here already. So we had the caribou he wanted, and we break camp and go to different places he wanted to go along the river and up to the Chip River, going through a lake, the Jaxpatia Lake, into the Chip, go up and see the different sites he wanted to see. Then come back down to the mouth, go out the channel and go to Tipaur, go up and take a look at it and come back. And he said, you know, this might be the last time I'm up by seeing this country. And then I never gave it a second thought. But he took me where he wanted to go. And then he showed me where he wanted to go, and I took him there. And that's the last time he went up there. Cheryl was with him during his last days.
You guys were out whaling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew he was going to leave us in April of 92. And he said, don't stay home. I said, I'm in good hands. You're out there hunting for your community. I don't want you guys waiting for me here. So you go out and hunt. And we told Cheryl to give a special code sign, and we didn't do it. She gave us the code sign, and we didn't do it because we were so busy looking at the whales trying to get our camp ready. And she finally hollered on the radio and said, get up here now. So we just pulled back our whaling gear, went up, but by then my dad had already left us.
So is that where you get your teasings from your dad?
A little bit. Yep. Yeah, quite a tease.
Yeah.
Yep. He can get you going, and then they had jokes for us. Pause and just I say it worked for quite a while. A couple minutes or so. I wonder what happens if then you perk up again and start talking about some other thing. You're never the same subject.
Why?
I don't know. Never really. Even though I've sat down and talked to him, what made him tick the most even when he went hunting? When he went out there. Away from the barrel. He loved to hunt. And I think if he had his own way, if he had his way, he would have had a house away from barrel. That's the way I look at it. We had a dream of going from the foothills and coming down the rivers and all the way to Bear while he was alive. Just follow the season, go up to the foothills and just follow the season down. And we never did it.
The old ways.
Mm-hmm. I've thought about doing it. That it's crossed my mind more than once. I might do it yet. He taught our boy, Patrick, a lot about hunting. How to shoot. What to look for. How to travel the winter time, how to travel the summertime. How to use the compass. He learned that from my dad. And also from my father-in-law, Andrew. We'd be at Uruk hunting and he'd be talking to him how to use the sun, his watch. We'd have a compass, how to use the watch as a compass. How to observe the current, the ice current, the wind. But Fetrick knows a lot about traveling and camping. For a 16-year-old, more so than a lot of kids that are in his age group.
Lucky.
Not really luck, I've been pushing him to learn. Yes. Then the way he'll know what to do when the situation arises. Like I was taught by my dad. I was pushed. I was never really a boy, a small boy. I took care of the dogs. We had the dog team. Every winter, when the winter set in, I had to make that great, great big pot and fill it up with whatever meat that he wanted me to make the pot with and boil it and put farina in it. And from there, I'd be eating my caribou meat or my seal meat, walrus meat, while I was cooking the dog food. I would eat some of that meat and I would cook it. If the pot was clean. Then one of my responsibilities was making sure the dogs got plenty to feed. And they were fed every day.
How many dogs?
He had about 7 to 9 dogs.
Did he always tell the same stories about the, you know, he told me about this whale or that time polar bear hunting or I wonder if he always, like, you know, you've heard all those stories how many times?
Oh yes. He talks like when we were doing, just like when we were seal hunting. We tried to let Harry, my baby brother, shoot a polar bear. We had already gotten a seal. And the polar bear was about 20 feet from us. And Harry didn't want to shoot, so my dad looked at him and said, "Are you ready?" He said, "Yeah." We both shot, and when we hit the polar bear on the neck, we're within 1 inch of each other. And it was on the young ice, and it was moving, so dad got a hold of that rope, and he's going to lasso the head with that rope around the neck so we can pull it under that sure fast ice. And the polar bear tilted his head and growled. And my dad just finished putting that thing on real quick and said, Nugarovic gave it the final touch. So I went open, put it on the base of the neck and shot it. And we just pulled it on the ice. And it was an 11-foot polar bear. We had that polar bear skin made into a rug in our tent.
Oh, it's that bear.
That bear, that's the one we had for years. I think we're going to find a put it to rest here this season. The hair, all the long hair has gone on it. We had it for what? The hair is what? We had it for almost 15 years, that skin.
So Harry was like a teenager then.
Mm-hmm. He's about 35 now, so about 15, 16 years that we've had that polar bear skin for a rug on our whaling. We go whaling.
One of the things I've been listening to these tapes and the thing, little bits of stories, really, I kind of feel like from your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if he had a reason he was trying to tell me these things.
He's trying to tell you the geography of the land, of where he was at different seasons. Like when he went grand, maybe, I don't know if he told you the story, but when he went marmot hunting for Old Man Okumaya up in the foothills.
So.
You look at those tapes and you listen to them. Try to visualize what animals he's talking to you about. That's going to correlate with the season. Winter, spring, fall. And the roughly the geographical location of the Arctic. It's a history lesson of the Arctic. On those tapes, you've got more history of where these things happen in his life than during the younger days when he experienced.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that big rock they've got over on the eastern side. That's what they call that. What was it, Ruby or what? That red rock he talks about. That rock.
What?
That rock. That they left behind. A ruby or something. And they told him to leave it alone. Very precious rock.
Oh, amber.
Amber. Is it amber or something?
I remember him talking about amber.
And this, and about the gold on the Kvikbuk River.
I don't remember that part.
But out of guys is fine. And about the mammoth just sticking out from the riverbank on the Kvikbuk. Really, when Kieran was heading down the coastline by himself, on the Inaru, or a place called Nigliavik.
Place for Nigliavik?
Yeah. Nigliavik, yeah. I once time he had the polar bear cups. He used to cook and I would have two polar bears cups that he had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember him telling me when he was a kid or something, there was at least one, I didn't remember two, that would follow him around everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And they were getting so big that he had to put them in a cage on the sailboat and let them go.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories that he's told over the years, that different places where he's been at. Like at Payukovic, when he used to go up there and there'd be two or three families living there.
Mm-hmm.
And the old man, Leo Kaler, when he used to be with the whaling crew, same age as Tom Brower. how Clearville up there got started. You guys have old man Clear. How about different geese hunting sites that we used to go to? Hunting Pollard. He traveled the country. He knows the country up here.
That's what it always seemed like to me.
Pardon?
I wish I could have had a chance to go out on the country with her. It sounds like that was the place to be.
I've been to some of the places he's talked about, and it's awesome. When it's getting in March, start getting a lot of daylight, or starting to warm up in March, April. There's going to be up there. Charlotte knows I was going to go up there for a week, and I ended up finding a note on the cabin. You've been gone 3 weeks. Kick your rear end home.
No, I've just been out camping for a couple days at a time, and I don't want to come back.
No, the country up where we got the boys got the upper cabin is very, very nice.
I've flown over that. It's beautiful. You know, sometimes I think about if your dad is trying to teach me some kind of lessons or something that I was missing. I feel like I didn't get it. Maybe there wasn't a bigger lesson besides what...
He's trying to pass on the history of the Arctic, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
What it was then and what it is now. When they should travel with the dog team, and the sailboat, and the dock boat and the skin boat, versus the high-speed outboard that takes you a couple hours here or there. 4 hours here, there would normally teach take 2 days, 4 days, a matter of hours here, there. Would just take weeks. And how fast you miss, be traveling so fast that you miss seeing these different things that they have served running with the dog team or playing with the dog team. And how quiet you can get beyond a herd of caribou. Or wolf eating off a caribou with your dog team, your dog is so quiet versus the being spooked already because you have a snow machine. Things that I can't think how he thought when you start telling the different segments of his stories of his lifetime when he's gone through. But like I said earlier, you might be trying to give you the history of the slope,
mm-hmm.
you know, the different seasons and the animals.
Well, it seemed like he wanted people to know what he knew. He wanted
yes.
to pass that on.
He knew about the Arctic more so than even the people living in Kaktovik. They talk about anywhere. You say, them people, they have never been anywhere other than a few places in that country up there. He said, they're not qualified to speak about anywhere. I mean, they don't know what they're talking about.
I just listened to that part of the tape last week. And it talks about that.
Am I saying what he's saying?
No, you're confirming what he's saying. No.
Very much to confirm what he's saying about the people constantly talking about saying that they know anymore. Well, the different people in the audience looks in there, they and where they don't. They've never traveled the country. They've never seen the country. They might have flown over it. But they've never been at the place where it's been at.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even they don't even know where up at by Straight Lake or Peter's Lake where from the mountain top it flows into one lake and from the other side it flows into the other. It flows both ways, one toward the ocean,
mm-hmm.
one toward up inland. Upland. Just like her father and my father knew the crossing at the end of Colville,
mm-hmm.
where you portage over to North Dot River. A real quick portage. A lot of people don't know it. I don't know it. But they knew the way.
Now that would be a fun trip.
Mm-hmm.
To go retrace that trail.
Charlotte's father talked about it. My dad talked about it. I talked about it more than once. How to get a bit through Colville. And there's a place in Colville you don't even go to because of the gas that comes out of the ground. There's places up there where animals come in nighttime and they don't come out. So the carp is out there, but you go in, you don't come out. And it's like down in by Big Miguel River Creek below Point Lay. There's something in the ground that comes out that makes you hallucinate. Where did you start seeing things?
Your dad was from a well-known big family. How were things with his siblings?
Yeah. Well, they each had their own life. He came from a big, well-known family, the Brow family. But to me, when I was growing up, my dad kept to himself. He didn't really associate a lot with the other older siblings. There might have been some animosity because of the way they dealt with him when his parents passed away.
What happened?
They took his camping, his whaling gear. His older brother Tom Brown took his whaling gear away from him. And then from the store, when he tried to charge, because he wasn't working, he was living off the trapping, that the storekeeper said that you can't charge your groceries here. So my dad would just pick up the stuff that were needed to support the family, and he'd go home and write them down. Then after he had enough boxes, he'd take the box belt over and said, this is the payment for the stuff I took, and here's the list. Clean out my account. So, but over the years, and when they start getting a little old, they reconcile their differences. But there's some hard feelings my father had toward his older brothers for many years.
What about his sisters?
Well, he was close to Mariah, Sadie. Mary was just a pest. And he says, "You, that girl, don't know nothing," he used to say. Very close to those three women. And then he talked about the time he would own San Fernando Valley. His mother hadn't gotten sick or hadn't said no when his aunt down there had a ranch, told him to come on down and take care of the ranch. She sold off the land and just took a small place for herself over the hilltop. Had a big cattle ranch down there. He used to tell us we'd be down there, we'd be flying up here in a jet of our own jet just to go camping or hunting. He told Charlotte and me that more than once.
Think he would have been happy living in San Fernando Valley?
I don't know. I've never been there. But from what I get together, it's quite a place. The ranch that she had was far as I could see over the horizon was handsome, was her property. Great big ranch. Mother told him, nope. She must have been feeling that she was something wrong with her, but that same year, the following year, mother passed away. But he was a young man and he wanted to go down. Was it Lisbeth? Was it Lisbeth? Talk about they had that ranch down there. Or Florence.
Florence,
I think. Either at least for the Florence, one of them at the ranch. And he had seen my dad as a young man, and he wanted him to come down and take care of the ranch. She was getting up in her years. There's his half sister from my grandfather's first marriage, Dr. It was about 19 years spread between my dad and Uncle Tom, so.
So Florence then was
even. He was even older.
This is sort of an off the side question because somebody else asked me this who's doing work in Shishmaref, and he didn't realize the Shishmaref barrel connection, or he had just learned about it recently, so I was talking to him about it. Do you know when Asimatuk and her brothers and whomever else in her family, do you know the story of them coming here?
Yeah, my father talked about where his brother. Well, no, he used to carry her and bring her up. They went through from Shishmaref up the coastline and up through Anaktuba, from Anaktuba down here to Barrow. And well, Anak was the one that cared for her. He had Asuak. Is it Asuak? Well, Anak. Mumegana, and one more. I never really got the four brothers' names. Mumegana.
There's
Talak. Asuak. No. Talak. Oeanak. Aluix? And one more. Four brothers. I never really got the name. I've never heard the fourth one spoken.
It's not Momogan.
I think it's Momogan, but I always think it's Momogan, Oeanak, Talak, and Aluix.
I can't say.
Oweanak.
Right.
Look it up on the Sadie Brower book. He talks about the four brothers.
No, that's where I looked it up before for this guy. I didn't look up the brothers' names though. I'm sure your dad says it someplace on one of the tapes, I hope. Because he had that picture of at
the
least three
brothers.
Of them, or there were all four of them in that picture?
The three of them, I think.
Now, Taloc is a Sauk, same.
Taloc.
I thought there was an Asoak too.
Asoak? Old man Asoak? I know the old man Asoak, Marcus Twelfth's father.
Yeah. I think I've always thought.
Because he always called my dad little brother. They're cousins.
Yeah.
So it'd be one of the brothers.
I remembered.
Taloc, Asoak, Oyaknak.
I remember those three.
Of the three other I know most about. So it might have been Mumegana.
So who's Aluxi?
Aluxi would have been Taloc's, Aswak's father, maybe.